And that's my fault?
Yes. I do think you have a responsibility there. When we're out in the field, we have to show discipline and reserve at all times. We represent an absolutely key public agency.
Well, that's great, Ragnar, dear. One always learns something from you. Now I finally understand that I'm responsible for the fact that the head of research at Ericsson can't tell the difference between normal polite behaviour and flirting. Now I realise that I should blame myself when men indulge in such wildly wishful thinking that they see a sexual invitation in a simple smile.
Don't be stupid,
Olofsson said, and he disappeared. Later she regretted having answered back. That kind of outburst rarely does any good. On the other hand, she had been taking shit for far too long. It was time to stand up for herself. She quickly tidied her desk and got out a report from GCHQ in Britain about Russian industrial espionage against European software companies, which she had not yet had time to read. Then the telephone rang. It was Kraft, and that made Grana happy. She had never yet called to complain or moan. On the contrary.
"I'll get straight to the point," Kraft said. "I've had a call from the United States. It may be a bit of an emergency. Can you take it on your Cisco? We've arranged a secure line."
"Of course."
"Good. I'd like you to interpret the information for me, see if there's anything in it. It sounds serious, but I can't get a handle on the person who's passing it on. Who, by the way, says that she knows you. Put me through."
It was Ilona Casadas at the NSA. Although for a moment Grana wondered if it really was her. When they had last met, at a conference in Washington, D.C., Casales had been a self-assured and charismatic lecturer in what she somewhat euphemistically described as active signals surveillance. Hacking, in other words. Afterwards, she and Grana had gone out for drinks, and almost against her will, Grana had been enchanted. Casales smoked cigarillos and had a dark, sensuous voice, well-suited to her punchy one-liners and frequent sexual allusions. But now on the telephone she sounded confused, and sometimes unaccountably lost the thread of what she was saying. Blomqvist did not really know what to expect. A fashionable young man, presumably, some cool dude. But the fellow who had arrived looked like a tramp, short and with torn jeans and long, dark, unwashed hair, something slightly sleepy and shifty in his eyes. He was maybe 25, perhaps younger, had bad skin and a rather ugly mouth sore. Linus Brandel did not look like someone who was sitting on a major scoop.
"Linus Brandel, I presume?"
"That's right. Sorry I'm late. Happened to bump into a girl I knew. We were in the same class in 9th grade, and she—"
"Let's get this over with,"
Blomqvist interrupted him, and led the way to a table towards the back of the pub. When Amir appeared, smiling discreetly, they ordered 2 pints of Guinness, and then sat quietly for a few seconds. Blomqvist could not understand why he felt so irritated. It was not like him. Perhaps the whole drama with Serna was getting to him after all. He smiled at Arne and his gang, all of whom were studying them keenly.
"I'll come straight to the point," Brandel said.
"That sounds good.
Do you know Supercraft?"
Blomqvist did not know much about computer games, but even he had heard of Supercraft.
"By name, yes."
"No more than that?"
"No."
"In that case, you won't know that what makes this game different, or at least so special, is that it has a particular AI function. It allows you to communicate with a player about war strategy without being really sure, at least to begin with, whether you're talking to a real person or a digital creation."
"You don't say," Blomqvist said.
Nothing interested him less than the finer points of a damn game.
"It's a minor revelation in the industry, and I was actually involved in developing it," Randall said.
"Congratulations. In that case, you must have made a killing."
"That's just it."
"Meaning what?"
"The technology was stolen from us, and now True Games is making billions, or we don't get a single euro."
Blomqvist had heard this line before. He had even spoken to an old lady who claimed there was actually she who had written the Harry Potter books, and that J.K. Rowling had stolen everything by telepathy.
"So how did it happen?" he said.
"We were hacked."
"How do you know that?"
"It's been established by experts at the National Defense Radio Establishment. I can give you a name there, if you want, and also by a—"
Brandel hesitated.
"Yes?"
"Nothing. But even the security police were involved. You can talk to Gabriella Grana there. She's an analyst, and I think she'll back me up. She mentioned the incident in a report which she published last year. I have the reference number here.
In other words, this isn't news, Blomqvist interrupted.
No, not in that sense. New Technology and Computer Sweden wrote about it. But since France didn't want to talk, and on a couple of occasions even denied that there had been any breach at all, the story never went very far.
But it's still old news.
I suppose so.
So why should I be listening to you, Linus?
Because now France seems to have understood what happened. I think he's sitting on pure dynamite. He's become completely manic about security, only uses hyper-encryption for his phones and email, and he's just got a new burglar alarm with cameras and sensors and all that crap. I think you should talk to him. That's why I got in touch with you. A guy like you could get him to open up. He doesn't listen to me.
So you order me down here, because it seems as if someone called France may be sitting on some dynamite.
Not someone called France, Blomqvist. It's none other than Franz Balder, didn't I say that? I was one of his assistants.
Blomqvist searched his memory.
The only Balder he could think of was Hannah Balder, the actress. Whatever might have become of her.
"Who's he?" he said. The look he got was so full of contempt that he was taken aback.
"Where have you been living? Mars? Franz Balder is a legend, a household name."
"Really?"
"Christ, yes," Brandel said. "Google him and you'll see. He became a professor of computer sciences at just 27, and for 2 decades he's been a leading authority on research in artificial intelligence. There's hardly anyone who's as far advanced in the development of quantum computing and neural networks. He has an amazingly cool back-to-front brain, thinks along completely unorthodox, groundbreaking lines, and as you can probably imagine, the computer industry's been chasing him for years. But for a long time, Balder refused to let himself be recruited. He wanted to work alone. Well, not altogether alone. He's always had assistants. He's driven into the ground. He wants results, and he's always saying, nothing is impossible. Our job is to push back the frontiers, blah, blah, blah. But people listen to him. They'll do anything for him. They'll just about die for him. To us nerds, he is God Almighty.
I can hear that.
But don't think that I'm some star-struck admirer, not at all. There's a price to be paid. I know that better than anyone. You can do great things with him, but you can also go to pieces. Balder isn't even allowed to look after his own son. He messed up in some unforgivable way. There are a lot of different stories, assistants who've hit the wall and wrecked their lives and God knows what, but although he's always been obsessive, he's never behaved like this before. I just know he's onto something big.
You just know that.
You've got to understand he's not normally a paranoid person. Quite the opposite. He's never been anywhere near paranoid enough, given the level of the things he's been dealing with. But now he's locked himself into his house and hardly goes out. He seems afraid. And he really doesn't do scared.
And he was working on computer games, Blomqvist said, without hiding his scepticism.
Well, since he knew we were all gaming freaks, he probably thought we should get to work on something that we liked. But his AI program was also right for that business. It was a perfect testing environment, and we got fantastic results. We broke new ground. It was just...
Get to the point, Linus.
France and his lawyers wrote a patent application for the most innovative parts of the technology, and that's when the first shock came. A Russian engineer at True Games had thrown together an application just before which blocked our patent. It can hardly have been a coincidence. But that didn't really matter. The patent was only a paper tiger. The interesting thing was how the hell they had managed to find out about what we'd been doing. Since we were all devoted to France, even to the point of death, there was only one possibility. We must have been hacked, in spite of all our security measures.
Is that when you got in touch with SEPO and the National Defense Radio Establishment?
Not at first. Balder is not too keen on people who wear ties and work from 9 to 5. He prefers obsessive idiots who are glued to their computers all night long. So instead he got in touch with some weirdo hacker he had met somewhere, and she said straight away that we'd had a breach. Not that she seemed particularly credible. I wouldn't have hired her, if you see what I mean. And perhaps she was just talking drivel, but her main conclusions were nevertheless subsequently borne out by the people at the NDRE.
But no one knew who had hacked you?
No. No, trying to trace hacker breaches is often a complete waste of time. But they must have been professionals. We had done a lot of work on our IT security.
And now you suspect that Balder may have found out something more about it?
Definitely. Otherwise he wouldn't be behaving so strangely. I'm convinced he got wind of something at Solifon.
Is that where he worked?
Yes, oddly enough. As I told you before, Balder had previously refused to let himself be tied up by the big computer giants. No one has ever banged on as much as he did about being an outsider, about the importance of being independent and not being a slave to commercial forces. But out of the blue, as we stood there with our trousers down and our technology stolen, he suddenly accepted an offer from Solifon, of all companies. Nobody could understand it. Okay, they were offering a mega salary, free rein and all that crap. Like, do whatever the hell you want, just work for us, and that probably sounded cool. It would definitely have been cool for anyone who wasn't Franz Balder. But he'd had any number of offers like that from Google, Apple, and all the others. Why was this suddenly so interesting? He never explained. He just packed his stuff and disappeared, and from what I've heard, it went swimmingly at first. Balder continued to develop our technology, and I think Solifon's owner, Nicholas Grant, was beginning to fantasize about revenues in the billions. There was great excitement. But then something happened.
Something that you don't actually know so much about?
No. We lost contact. Balder lost contact with pretty much everyone, but I understand enough to know that it must have been something serious. He had always preached openness and enthused about the wisdom of crowds, all that stuff, the importance of using the knowledge of many, the whole Linux way of thinking. But at Solifon he apparently kept every comma secret, even from those who were closest to him, and then, wham bam, he gave notice and went home. And now he's sitting there in his house in Solchobaden and doesn't even go out into the garden or give a damn how he looks.
So what you've got, Linus, is a story about a professor who seems to be under pressure and who doesn't care what he looks like, though it's not clear how the neighbours can see that if he never goes outside.
Yes, but I think,
listen, this could be an interesting story, but unfortunately it isn't for me. I'm no IT reporter. As someone so wisely wrote the other day, I'm a caveman. I'd recommend you contact Raoul Sigvatsson at the Swedish Morning Post. He knows everything about that world.
No, no, Sigvatsson is a lightweight. This is way above his head.
I think you underestimate him.
Come on now, don't chicken out.
This could be your comeback, Blomqvist.
Blomqvist made a tired gesture towards Amir, who was wiping a table not far from them.
Can I give you some advice? Blomqvist said.
What? Yes, sure.
Next time you have a story to sell, don't try to explain to the reporter what's in it for him. Do you know how many times people have played me that tune? This is going to be the biggest thing in your career, bigger than Watergate. You'd do better with just some basic matter-of-fact information, Linus.
I just meant...
Yes, what actually did you mean?
That you should talk to Franz.
I think he would like you. You're the same uncompromising kind of guy.
It was as if Brandel had suddenly lost his self-confidence, and Blomqvist wondered if he had not been unnecessarily tough. As a general principle, he tended to be friendly and encouraging towards people who gave him tip-offs, however weird they sounded. Not just because there might be a good story, even in something that sounded crazy, but also because he recognized that often he was their last straw. There were many who turned to him when everyone else had stopped listening. He was the last hope, and there was never any excuse to be scornful.
"Listen," he said, "I've had a really bad day, and I didn't mean to sound sarcastic."
"That's okay."
"And you know," Blomqvist said, "there's one thing that interests me about this story. You said you had a visit from a female hacker."
Alona Casales was not one to become nervous easily, and she rarely had trouble staying on topic. She was 48, tall and outspoken, with a voluptuous figure and small, intelligent eyes which could make anybody feel insecure. She often seemed to see straight through people and did not suffer from a surfeit of deference to superiors. She would give anyone a dressing down, even the Attorney General, if he came calling. That was one of the reasons why Ed the Ned got on so well with her. Neither of them attached much importance to status. All they cared about was ability. Nevertheless, she had completely lost it with the head of Sweden's security police. This had nothing to do with Helena Kraft. It was because of the drama unfolding in the open-plan office behind her. Admittedly, they were all used to Needham's explosions of rage, but something told her right away that what was going on now was on an altogether different scale. The man seemed paralyzed. While Casadas sat there, blurting some confused words down the line, people gathered around him, and all of them, without exception, looked scared. But perhaps because she was in a state of shock, Casadas did not hang up, or say that she would call back later. She let herself be put through to Gabriela Grana, that charming young analyst whom she had met and tried to seduce in Washington. Even though Alona had not succeeded in taking her to bed, she had been left with a deep feeling of pleasure.
"Hello, my dear," she said. "How are you?"
"Not so bad," Grana answered. "We're having some terrible storms, but otherwise everything's fine. I really enjoyed that last time we saw each other."
"Absolutely, it was nice. I was hungover the whole of the next day, but I don't suppose you're calling to ask me out."
"Unfortunately not. I'm calling because we've picked up signs of a serious threat to a Swedish scientist."
"Who?"
"For a long time we had trouble understanding the information, or even working out which country it concerned. The communication was encrypted and used only vague code names. But still, once we got a few small pieces of the puzzle, we managed..."
"What the hell?"
"What?"
"One second."
Casales's computer screen blinked, then went blank, and as far as she could see, the same thing was happening all over the office floor. For a moment, she wondered what to do, but carried on the conversation. It might just be a power outage after all, although the overhead lights seemed to be working.
"I'm still here," said Grana.
"Thanks. I appreciate it. Sorry about this. It's complete chaos here. Where was I?"
"You were talking about pieces of the puzzle."
"Right, yes, we put two and two together, because there's always one person who's careless, however professional they try to be, or who..."
"Yes?"
"Talks, gives an address or something. In this case it was more like..."
Casales fell silent again. None other than Commander Johnny Ingram, one of the most senior people in the NSA with contacts high up in the White House, had come onto the office floor. Ingram was trying to appear as composed as usual. He even cracked some joke to a group sitting further away. But he was not fooling anyone. Beneath his polished and tanned exterior, ever since his time as head of the Cryptological Center in Oahu he was suntanned all year round, you could sense something nervous in his expression. Now he seemed to want everybody's attention.
"Hello? Are you still there?"
Grana said on the other end of the line.
"I'm going to have to leave you, unfortunately. I'll call you back,"
Casales said, and hung up. At that moment she became very worried indeed. There was a feeling in the air that something terrible had happened, maybe another major terrorist attack. But Ingram carried on with his soothing act, and even though there was sweat on his upper lip and forehead, he kept repeating that it was nothing serious. Most likely a virus, he said, which had found its way into the intranet despite all the security precautions.
"To be on the safe side, we've shut down our service," he said, and for a moment he really did manage to calm things down.
"What the hell?" people seemed to be saying. "A virus isn't such a big deal." But then Ingram started spouting such vague statements that Casales could not stop herself from shouting,
"Tell us what's actually happening!"
"We don't know that much yet, but it's possible that our systems have been hacked. We'll get back to you as soon as we know more," Ingram said, looking concerned, and a murmur ran through the room.
"Is it the Iranians again?" somebody wondered.
"We think," Ingram said.
He got no further. Ed Needham, the one person who should have been standing there in the first place, explaining what was happening, interrupted him brusquely and got to his feet. A bear of a man. At that moment there was no denying that he was an imposing sight. Gone was the deflated Needham from a minute before. He now exuded a tremendous sense of determination.
"No," he hissed, "it's a hacker. A fucking super hacker. And I'm going to cut his balls off."
"The female hacker doesn't really have anything to do with this story," said Brando, nursing his beer. "She was more like Baldur's social project."
"But she seemed to know her stuff."
"Or she was just lucky. She talked a lot of rubbish."
"So you met her?"
"Yes, just after Baldur took off for Silicon Valley."
"How long ago was that?"
"Almost a year. I'd moved our computers into my apartment on Brantingsgatan. My life was not great, to put it mildly. I was single and broke and hungover. My place looked like hell.
I'd just spoken to France on the telephone, and he'd been going on like some boring old dad. There was a lot of, don't judge her by how she looks, appearances can be deceptive, blah, blah. And hey, he said that to me. I'm not exactly the ideal son-in-law myself. I've never worn a jacket and tie in my entire life, and if anyone knows what people look like in the hacker community, then I do. Whatever. So I was sitting there waiting for this girl, thought that she would at least knock. But she just opened the door and walked in.
What did she look like?
Bloody awful. But then, she was also sexy, in a weird way. But dreadful.
Linus, I'm not asking you to rate her looks. I just want to know what she was wearing and if she maybe mentioned what her name was.
I have no idea who she was, Brandel said, although I did recognize her from somewhere. I had the feeling that it was something bad. She was tattooed and pierced and all that crap and looked like a heavy rocker or goth or punk. Plus, she was as thin as hell.
Hardly aware that he was doing it, Blomqvist gestured to Amir to pull him another Guinness.
What happened? Blomqvist said.
Well, what can I say? I guess I thought that we didn't have to get going right away, so I sat down on my bed. There wasn't much else to sit on, and suggested that we might have a drink or something first. But do you know what she did then? She asked me to leave. She ordered me out of my own home, as if that was the most natural thing in the world. Obviously, I refused. I was like, I do actually live here. But she said, piss off, get lost, and I didn't see what choice I had, so I was out for a while. When I got back, she was lying there on my bed, smoking. How sick is that? And reading a book about string theory or something. Maybe I gave her some sort of dodgy look, what do I know? And she said that she wasn't planning on having sex with me, not even a little. Not even a little, she said, and I don't think she looked at me in the eye even once. She just announced that we'd had a Trojan, a rat, and that she recognized the pattern in the breach, the level of originality in the programming. You've been blown, she said. And then she walked out.
Without saying goodbye?
Without a single damn word.
Christ.
But to be honest, I think she was bullshitting. The guy at the NDRE who did the same investigation a little while later, and who probably knew much more about these kinds of attacks, was very clear that you couldn't draw any conclusions like that, and that however much he searched through our computer, he couldn't find any spyware. But still, his guess was, Mulder was his name, by the way, Stefan Mulder, that we'd been hacked.
This woman, did she ever introduce herself in any way?
I did actually press her, but all she would say was that I could call her Pippi. Pretty surly she was, too. It was obvious that that wasn't her real name, but still.
What?
I thought it suited her somehow.
You know, Blomqvist said, I was just about to head home again.
Yes, I noticed that.
But now everything's changed in a pretty major way. Did you say that your Professor Balder knew this woman?
Well, yes.
In that case, I want to talk to him as soon as possible.
Because of the woman?
Something like that.
Okay, fine, Brandel said thoughtfully. But you won't find any contact details for him. He's become so bloody secretive, like I said. Do you have an iPhone?
I do.
In that case, you can forget it. Franz sees Apple as more or less in the pocket of the NSA. To talk to him, you'll have to buy a black phone, or at least borrow an Android and download a special encryption program. But I'll see to it that he gets in touch with you, so you can arrange to meet in some secure place.
Great, Linus. Thanks.
Chapter 4 November 20th Grana had just put on her coat to go home when Casales called again, and at first she was irritated, not only because of the confusion last time. She wanted to get going before the storm got out of hand. The news on the radio had forecast winds of up to 67 miles per hour, and the temperature falling to minus 10 degrees Celsius, and she was not dressed for it.
"I'm sorry it took a while," Casales said. "We've had an insane morning. Total chaos."
"Here too," Grana said politely, looking at her watch.
"But I do have something important to tell you, as I said. At least I think I do. It isn't that easy to analyze. I just started checking out a group of Russians. Did I mention that?"
Casales said.
"No."
"Well, there are probably Germans and Americans involved, and possibly one or more Swedes."
"What sort of group are we talking about?"
"Criminals. Sophisticated criminals who don't rob banks or sell drugs. Instead, they steal corporate secrets and confidential business information."
"Black hats."
"They're not just hackers. They also blackmail and bribe people. Possibly they even commit old-fashioned crimes like murder. I don't have much on them yet, to be honest. Mostly code names and unconfirmed links, and then a couple of real names, some young computer engineers in junior positions. The group is active in suspected industrial espionage, and that's why the case has ended up on my desk. We're afraid that cutting-edge American technology has fallen into Russian hands. I understand. But it isn't easy to get at them. They're good at encryption, and no matter how hard I try, I haven't been able to get any closer to their leadership than to catch that their boss goes by the name of Thanos.
Thanos?
Yes, derived from Thanatos, the god of death in Greek mythology, the one who's the son of Nyx, a knight, and twin brother to Hypnos, sleep.
Real cloak-and-dagger stuff.
Actually, it's pretty childish. Thanos is a supervillain in Marvel Comics. You know that comic book series with heroes like the Hulk, Iron Man, and Captain America? First of all, it's not particularly Russian, but more than that, it's... how do I put this? Both playful and arrogant? Yes, like a bunch of cocky college kids messing around, and that really annoys me. In fact, there's a whole lot that worries me about this story, and that's why I got so worked up when we learned through our signal surveillance that someone in the network may have defected, somebody who could maybe give us some insight. If only we could get our hands on this guy before they do. But now that we've looked more carefully, we realize it wasn't at all what we thought.
Meaning what?
The guy who quit wasn't some criminal, but the opposite. An honest person who resigned from a company where this organization has moles. Someone who, presumably, stumbled on some key information.
Keep going.
In our view, this person is now seriously under threat. He needs protection, but until recently we had no idea where to look for him. We didn't even know which company he'd worked at. But now we think we've zeroed in,
Casada said.
You see, in the last few days one of these characters mentioned something about this guy, said that with him all the bloody T's went up in smoke.
The bloody T's?
Yes. Cryptic and strange, but it had the advantage of being specific and highly searchable. While bloody T's didn't give us anything, T's generally, words beginning with T in conjunction with companies, high-tech firms, of course, kept leading us to the same place. To Nicholas Grant and his maxim, tolerance, talent, and teamwork.
We're talking Soliphon here, right?
Grana said. We think so. At least it felt like everything had fallen into place, so we began to investigate who had left Soliphon recently. The company always has such high staff turnover. It's part of their philosophy, that talent should flow in and out. But then we started to think specifically about those T's. Are you familiar with them?
Not really.
They're Grant's recipe for creativity. By tolerance, he means that you need to be open to unconventional ideas and unconventional people. Talent. It doesn't just achieve results, it attracts other gifted people and helps create an environment that people want to be in. And all these talents have to form a team. As I'm sure you know, Soliphon was a remarkable success story, producing pioneering technology in a whole series of fields. But then this new genius popped up, a Swede. And with him, all the bloody T's went up in smoke.
Exactly.
And it was Franz Balder. I don't think he normally has any problem with tolerance, or with teamwork, for that matter. But from the beginning, there was apparently something toxic about him. He refused to share anything, and in no time at all, he managed to destroy the rapport among the elite researchers at the company, especially when he started accusing people of being thieves and copycats. There was a scene with the owner, too. But Grant has refused to tell us what it was about, just that it was something private. Soon after, Balder gave notice.
I know.
Most people were probably relieved when he took off. The air at work became easier to breathe, and people began to trust each other again, at least up to a point. But Grant wasn't happy, and more importantly, his lawyers weren't happy either. Balder had taken with him whatever he had been developing at Soliphon, and there was a rumor, maybe because no one really knew what it was, that he was onto something sensational that could revolutionize the quantum computer, which Soliphon was working on. And from a purely legal point of view, whatever he'd produced belonged to the company and not to him personally.
Correct.
So even though Balder had been going on about theft, when all was said and done, he himself was the thief.
Any day now things are likely to blow up in court, as you know, unless Balder manages to use whatever he has to frighten the lawyers. That information is his life insurance, so he says, and it may well be true. But in the worst-case scenario, it could also be the death of him. That's what I'm afraid of, Casales said. We're picking up stronger indications that something serious is getting underway, and your boss tells me that you might be able to help us.
Grana looked at the storm that was now raging outside and longed desperately to go home and get away from it all. Yet she took off her coat and sat down again, feeling uneasy.
How can I help?
What do you think he found out?
Do I take that to mean that you haven't managed either to bug him or hack him? I'm not going to answer that one, sweetheart. But what do you think?
Grana remembered how Franz Balder had stood in the doorway of her office not so long ago, and muttered about dreaming of a new kind of life, whatever he may have meant by that.
I assume you know, she said. I met him before he joined Soliphon, because he claimed that his research had been stolen. I didn't warm to him much at first. Then there was talk in-house of getting him some form of protection, so I met him again. His transformation over the last few weeks was incredible, not only because he had shaved off his beard, tidied up his hair and lost some weight. He was also mellower, even a little bit unsure of himself. I could tell he was rattled, and at one point he did say that he thought there were people who wanted to harm him.
In what way?
Not physically, he said. It was more his research and his reputation they were after. But I'm not so sure. Deep down, he believed it would stop there. So I suggested he get a guard dog. I thought a dog would be excellent company for a man who lived out in the suburbs in far too big a house. But he wouldn't hear of it. I can't have a dog now, he said rather sharply.
Why's that, do you think?
I really don't know. But I got the feeling there was something weighing on him. He didn't protest too much when I arranged for a sophisticated alarm system in his house. It has just been installed.
By whom?
A company we often use, Milton Security.
Good.
But my recommendation is to move him to a safe house.
Is it that bad?
We think the risk is real.
Okay, Grana said. If you send over some documentation, I'll have a word with my superior right away. I'll see what I can do, but I'm not sure what I can get my hands on. We've been having some computer issues.
Can an agency like yours really afford that sort of thing?
No, you're right.
Let me get back to you, sweetheart, she said, and hung up.
Grana remained quite still and looked out at the storm lashing against the window with increasing fury. Then she picked up her black phone and rang Balder. She let it ring and ring. Not just to warn him and see to it that he moved to a safe place at once, but also because she suddenly wanted to know what he had meant when he said, "These last few days I've been dreaming about a new kind of life." No one would have believed that at that moment Balder was fully occupied with his son. Blomqvist remained sitting for a while after Brandel had left, drinking his Guinness and staring into the distance. Behind him, Arne and his gang were laughing at something. But Blomqvist was so engrossed in his thoughts that he heard nothing, and hardly even noticed that Amir had sat down next to him and was giving him the latest weather forecast. The temperature was dropping. The first snow of the year was expected to fall, and not in any pleasant or picturesque way. The misery was going to come blasting in sideways in the worst storm the country had seen for a long time.
"Good get hurricane force winds," Amir said,
and Blomqvist, who still was not listening, just said,
"That's good."
"Good?"
"Yes. Well, better than no weather at all."
"I suppose. But are you all right? You look shaken up. Was it a useful meeting?"
"Sure, it was fine."
"But what you got to hear rattled you, didn't it?"
"I'm not certain. Things are just a mess right now.
I'm thinking of quitting Millennium."
"I thought you basically were that magazine."
"I thought so too.
But I guess there's an end to everything."
"That's probably true," Amir said. "My old man used to say that there's even an end to eternity."
"What did he mean by that?"
"I think he was talking about love everlasting. It was shortly before he left my mother."
Blomqvist snorted.
"I haven't been so good at everlasting love myself. On the other hand..."
"Yes, Mikael?"
"There's a woman I used to know."
She's been out of my life for some time now.
Tricky.
Well, yes, it is. But now I've suddenly had a sign of life from her. Or at least I think I did. And perhaps that's what's got me looking a bit funny.
Right.
I'd better get myself home. What do I owe you?
We can settle up another time.
Great. Take care of me, he said. He walked past the regulars who threw a few random comments at him and stepped into the storm. It was a near-death experience. Gusts of wind blew straight through his body, but in spite of them he stood still for a while, lost in old memories. He thought about a dragon tattoo on a skinny, pale back, a cold snap on Hedeby Island in the midst of a decades-old missing person case, and a dug-up grave in Gossaberga that was nearly the resting place of a woman who refused to give up. Then he walked home slowly. For some reason he had trouble getting the door open, had to jiggle the key around. He kicked off his shoes and sat at his computer and searched for information on Franz Balder, professor. But he was alarmingly unfocused, and instead found himself wondering, as he had so many times before, where had she disappeared to? Apart from some news from her one-time employer, Dragan Armansky, he had not heard a word about her. It was as if she had vanished off the face of the earth, and although they lived in more or less the same part of town, he had never caught a glimpse. Of course, the person who had turned up at Brandell's apartment that day could have been someone else. It was possible, but not likely. Who else would come stomping in like that? It must have been Salander and Pippi. That was typical. The nameplate on her apartment door on Fiskargarten was V. Kuller, and he could well see why she did not use her real name. It was all too searchable and associated with one of the most high-profile trials the country had ever seen. Admittedly, it was not the first time that the woman had vanished in a puff of smoke, but ever since that day when he had knocked on her door on Lundegarten and given her hell for having written a personal investigation report about him which was rather too thorough, they had never been apart for so long. It felt a little strange, didn't it? After all, Salander was his... Well, what the hell was she, in point of fact? Hardly his friend. One sees one's friends. Friends don't only get in touch by hacking into your computer. Yet he still felt this bond with Salander, and above all, he worried about her. Her old guardian, Holger Palmgren, used to say that Lisbeth Salander would always manage. Despite her appalling childhood, or maybe because of it, she was one hell of a survivor, and there was probably a lot of truth in that. But one could never be sure, not with a woman of such a background, and with that knack for making enemies. Perhaps she really had gone off the rails, as Armansky had hinted when he and Blomqvist met over lunch at Gondolin about 6 months ago. It was a spring day, a Saturday, and Armansky had offered to buy beer and schnapps and all the rest of it. Even though they were ostensibly meeting as two old friends, there was no doubt that Armansky only wanted to talk about Salander and, with the help of a few drinks, indulge in a spot of sentimentality. Among other things, Armansky told Blomqvist that his company, Milton Security, had supplied a number of personal alarms to a nursing home in Högdalen. Good equipment, he said. But not even the best equipment in the world will help you if the electricity goes off, and nobody can be bothered to fix it. And that is precisely what happened. There was a power outage at the home late one evening, and in the course of that night one of the residents, a lady called Ruth Åkerman, fell and broke her femur. And she lay there for hour after hour, pressing the button on her alarm, to no avail. By the morning she was in critical condition, and since the papers were just then focusing heavily on negligence in care for the elderly, the whole thing became a big deal. Happily the old lady pulled through, but she also happened to be the mother of a senior figure in the Swedish Democrats' party. When it emerged on the party's website, unpixelated, that Armansky was an Arab, which, incidentally, he was not at all, although it was true that he was occasionally called the Arab in jest, there was an explosion in the posted comments. Hundreds of anonymous writers said that's what happens when you let coons supply your technology. Armansky took it very badly, especially when the trolling affected his family. But then suddenly, as if by magic, all those posts were no longer anonymous. You could see the names and addresses of those responsible, their job titles and how old they were. It was beautifully neat, as if they had all filled in a form. You could say that the entire site had been unpixelated,
and of course it became clear that the posts did not just come from crackpots, but also from many established citizens, even some of Armansky's competitors in the security business. For a long time, the hitherto anonymous perpetrators were completely powerless. They could not understand what had happened. Eventually someone managed to close the site down, but nobody had any idea who lay behind the attack. Except for Dragan Armansky himself.
"It was classic Salander," he said. "You know, I hadn't heard from her for ages and was convinced that she couldn't give a damn about me or anybody else for that matter. But then this happened, and it was fantastic. She had stood up for me. I sent an effusive thanks by email, and to my surprise, an answer came back. Do you know what she wrote?"
"No."
"Just one single sentence. 'How the hell can you protect that creep Sandval at the Ustermann Clinic?'"
"And who's Sandval?"
"A plastic surgeon to whom we gave personal protection because he'd been threatened. He'd poured a young Estonian woman on whom he had performed breast surgery, and she happened to be the girlfriend of a known criminal."
"Oops."
"Precisely. Not such a clever thing to do. I answered Salander to say that I didn't think Sandval was one of God's little angels any more than she did, but I pointed out that we don't have the right to make that kind of judgment. Even male chauvinist pigs are entitled to some degree of security. Since Sandval was under serious threat, and asked for our help, we gave it to him. At double the usual rate."
"But Salander didn't buy your argument?"
"Well, she didn't reply. At least not by email. But I suppose you could say she gave a different sort of answer."
"What do you mean?"
"She marched up to our guards at the clinic and ordered them to keep calm. I even think she gave them my regards. Then she walked straight past all the patients and nurses and doctors, went into Sandval's office, and broke three of his fingers, and made the most terrifying threats against him."
"Jesus,
that's putting it mildly. Stark staring mad. I mean, to do something like that in front of so many witnesses, and in a doctor's office on top of it all. And, of course, there was a huge fuss afterwards. A lot of brouhaha about lawsuits and prosecutions, and the whole damn thing. You can just imagine, breaking the fingers of a surgeon who's lined up to perform a string of lucrative nips and tucks. It's the kind of thing that gets top lawyers seeing dollar signs everywhere."
"What happened?"
"Nothing. It all came to nothing, apparently, because the surgeon himself didn't want to take things any further. But still, Mika, it was insane. No person in their right mind steams into a top surgeon's office in broad daylight and breaks his fingers. Not even Salander."
Blomqvist actually thought that it sounded pretty logical, according to Salander logic, that is, a subject in which he was more or less expert. He did not doubt for one second that that doctor had done far worse than groped the wrong girlfriend. But even so, he could not help wondering if Salander hadn't screwed up in this case, if only on the score of risk analysis. It occurred to him that she might have wanted to get into trouble again, maybe to put some spice back into her life, but that was probably unfair. He knew nothing of her motives or her current circumstances. As the storm rattled the window panes and he sat there in front of his computer, googling Franz Walder, he tried to see beauty in the fact that they had now bumped into each other in this indirect way. It would seem that Salander was the same as ever, and perhaps, who knows, she had given him a lead. Linus Brandel had irritated him from the word go, but when Salander dropped into the story, he saw it all with new eyes. If she had taken the time to help Franz Walder, then he could at least take a closer look at it, and with some luck, find out a bit more about Salander at the same time. Why had she gotten herself involved in the first place? She was not just some itinerant IT consultant, after all. Yes, she could fly into a rage over life's injustices, but for a woman who had no qualms about hacking to get indignant about a computer breach, that was a little bit surprising. Breaking the fingers of a plastic surgeon, fine, but hackers? That was very much like throwing stones at glass houses. There must be some back story. Maybe she and Baldo knew each other. It was not inconceivable, and so he tried googling their names together, but without getting any hits, at least not any that had relevance. He focused on Franz Walder. The professor's name generated 2 million hits, but most of them were scientific articles and commentaries. It did not seem as if Walder gave interviews, and because of that there was a sort of mythological gloss over the details of his life, as if they had been romanticized by admiring students. Apparently, it had been assumed that Walder was more or less mentally disabled as a child until one day he walked into the headmaster's office at his school on Ekerö Island
and pointed out a mistake in the ninth-grade maths books, to do with so-called imaginary numbers. The mistake was corrected in subsequent editions, and the following spring Balder won a national mathematics competition. He was reported as being able to speak backwards and create his own long palindromes. In an early school essay, later published online, he took a critical view of H.G. Wells's novel The War of the Worlds, on the grounds that he could not understand how beings superior to us in every way could fail to grasp something so basic as the differences between bacterial flora on Mars and on Earth. After graduating from secondary school, he studied computer sciences at Imperial College in London and defended his thesis on algorithms in neural networks, which was considered revolutionary. He became the youngest ever professor at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm and was elected to the Royal Swedish Academy of Engineering Sciences. These days he was regarded as a world authority on the hypothetical concept of technological singularity, the state at which computer intelligence would have overtaken our own. In most photographs he looked like a dishevelled troll with small eyes, his hair standing on end. Yet he married the glamorous actress Anna Lind. The couple had a son who, according to evening newspaper coverage, under the headline Hannah's Great Sorrow, was mentally disabled, even though the boy did not, at least not in the picture accompanying the article, look in the least bit impaired. The marriage fell apart, and amidst a heated custody battle in Nacka District Court, the enfant terrible of the theatre, Lasse Westman, stepped into the fray to declare aggressively that Balder should not be allowed to look after his son because he cared more about the intelligence of computers than that of children. Blomqvist concentrated his efforts on trying to understand Balder's research, and for a long time he sat engrossed in a complicated text about quantum processors in computers. Afterwards, he went into documents and opened a file he had created a year or so earlier. It was called Lisbeth's Stuff. He had no idea whether she was still hacking into his computer, but he could not help hoping that she did, and wondered if he should not, after all, type out a little greeting. Long personal letters were not her thing. He would do better to go for something brisk and a bit cryptic. He wrote, "What should we make of Franz Balder's artificial intelligence?" Chapter 5. November 20th. The words blinked onto the computer screen. "Mission accomplished." Plague gave a hoarse, almost deranged yell, and that may have been unwise. But even if the neighbours had happened to hear, they could not have dreamed what it was about. Plague's home was not an obvious setting for high-level international security coups. It felt more like a place where a social welfare case might hang out. Plague lived on Höglingtavegen in Sundbyberg, a markedly unglamorous area with dull, four-story, faded brick houses, and the apartment itself had nothing much going for it. It had a sour, stale smell, and his desk was covered in all sorts of rubbish. McDonald's containers and Coca-Cola cans, crumpled up pages from notebooks, unwashed coffee cups, and empty candy wrappers. Even though some had actually made it into the waste paper basket, which had not been emptied for weeks, you could hardly take a step in the room without getting crumbs or grit under your feet. But none of this would have surprised anyone who knew him. Plague was not a man who normally showered or changed his clothes much. He spent his whole life in front of the computer, even when he was not working. A giant of a man, overweight, bloated and unkempt, with an attempt at an imperial beard that had long since turned into a shapeless thicket. His posture was dreadful, and he had a habit of groaning when he moved. But the man had other talents. He was a wizard on the computer, a hacker who flew unconstrained through cyberspace, and was probably second only to one person in the field, a woman, in this particular case. The mere sight of his fingers dancing across the keyboard was a joy to behold. He was as light and nimble online as he was heavy and clumsy in the other, more material world. And as a neighbour somewhere upstairs, presumably Herr Jansson, now banged on the floor, he answered the message he had received. "Wasp, you bloody genius! They ought to put up a statue to you." Then he leaned back, with a delighted smile, and tried to run through in his mind the sequence of events, savouring the triumph for a little while longer before going on to pump Wasp for every detail, and to ensure that she had covered her tracks. No one must be able to trace them, no one. This was not the first time they had messed with a powerful organisation, but this was on a new level, and many in Hacker Republic had actually been against the idea.
Wasp herself, most of all. Wasp could take on just about any authority or person you would care to name, if it were necessary, but she did not like picking a fight for its own sake. She disliked that sort of childish hacker nonsense. She was not someone who hacked into supercomputers merely to show off. Wasp wanted to have a clear objective, and she always damn well analyzed the potential consequences. She weighed long-term risks against whatever need was being satisfied in the short term. And from that point of view, it could not be said it made sense to hack into the NSA. Still, she let herself be talked into it. Nobody could quite understand why. Maybe she was bored and wanted to stir up a bit of chaos so as not to die of tedium. Or else, as some in the group claimed, she was already in conflict with the NSA, and therefore the breach amounted to little more than her personal revenge. But others in the group questioned even that, and maintained she was looking for information, that she'd been on the hunt for something ever since her father, Alexander Zarachenko, had been murdered at Salgrenska Hospital in Yotnobori. Nobody knew for sure. Wasp had always had her secrets, and actually her motives were unimportant, or so they tried to persuade themselves. If she was prepared to help, then they should just accept gratefully and not worry about the fact that, to begin with, she had not shown much enthusiasm, or hardly any feelings at all, for that matter. At least she was no longer being awkward about it, and that seemed as much as anyone could expect. Hacker Republic knew better than most that the NSA had outrageously overstepped its boundaries in recent years. These days the organization did not confine itself to eavesdropping on terrorists and potential security risks, or even just foreign heads of state and other powerful figures, but listened in on everything, or nearly everything. Millions, billions, trillions of communications and activities online were spied on and archived, and with each passing day the NSA went further and further and pried deeper and deeper into every private life. The agency had become one immeasurable, watchful, evil eye. It was true that nobody in Hacker Republic could claim the moral high ground here. Every single one of them had made their way into parts of the digital landscape where they had no business being. Those were the rules of the game, so to speak. A hacker was someone who crossed the line, for better or for worse, someone who, by virtue of his occupation, broke rules and broadened the frontiers of his knowledge, without always being concerned about the distinction between private and public. But they were not without ethics, and above all they knew, also from their own experience, how power corrupts, especially power without control. None of them liked the thought that the worst, most unscrupulous hacking was no longer carried out by solitary rebels or outlaws, but by state behemoths who wanted to control their populations. Plague and Trinity and Bob the Dog and Flipper and Zod and Cat and the whole Hacker Republic gang had therefore decided to strike back by hacking the NSA and messing with them in one way or another. That was no simple task. It was a little bit like stealing the gold from Fort Knox, and like the arrogant idiots they were, they did not content themselves with breaking into the system. They also wanted super-user status, or root in Linux language, and for that they needed to find unknown vulnerabilities in the system, for what was called a zero-day exploit. First on the NSA's server platform, and then further into the organization's intranet, NSAnet, from which the authorities' signals surveillance went out across the world. They began, as usual, with a little social engineering. They had to get hold of the names of systems administrators and infrastructure analysts who held the complex passwords for the intranet. It would not do any harm, either, if there was a chance that some careless oaf was being negligent about security routines. Through their own contacts, they came up with 4 or 5 names, among them one Richard Fuller. Fuller worked in the NISIRT, the NSA Information Systems Incident Response Team, which supervised the intranet, and he was constantly on the lookout for leaks and infiltrators. Fuller was a decent sort of fellow, a Harvard law graduate, Republican, former quarterback, a dream patriot if one were to believe his CV. But through a former lover, Bob the Dog managed to discover that he was also bipolar, and possibly a cocaine addict. When Fuller got excited, he would do all sorts of stupid things, such as opening files and documents without first putting them in a so-called sandbox, a required security protocol. Furthermore, he was very handsome and a little smarmy, and someone, probably Bob the Dog himself, came up with the idea that Wasp should travel to his home in Baltimore, go to bed with him, and catch him in the honey trap. Wasp told them all to go to hell. She also rejected their next idea, that they would compile a document containing information which looked like dynamite, specifically about infiltrators and leaks at the head office in Fort Meade. This would then be infected with malware containing an advanced Trojan with a high level of originality, which Plague and Wasp were to develop. The plan was to put out leads online which would lure Fuller to the file, and with a bit of luck get him so worked up that he would be careless with security. Not a bad plan at all. It could take them into the NSA's computer system without an active breach that might be traceable. But Wasp said that she was not going to sit around waiting for that blockhead Fuller to put his foot in it. She did not want to have to rely on other people making mistakes. She was being generally contrary and bloody-minded, so no one was surprised when she suddenly wanted to take over the whole operation herself. Even though there was a certain amount of protest, in the end they all gave in, but not without issuing a series of instructions. Wasp did carefully write down the names and details of the system's administrators which they had managed to obtain, and she did ask for help with the so-called fingerprinting, the mapping of the server platform and operating system. But after that she closed the door on Hacker Republic and the world, and Plague had no reason to think that she paid any attention to his advice. For example, that she should not use her handle, her alias, and that she should not work from home but rather from some remote hotel under a false identity, in case the NSA's bloodhounds managed to track her down. Needless to say, she did everything her own way, and all Plague could do was sit at his desk in Sunbury and wait, his nerves in tatters. Which is why he still had no idea how she had gone about it. He knew one thing for certain. What she had achieved was legendary, and while the storm howled outside, he pushed aside some of the rubbish on his desk, leaned forward, and typed on his computer. "Tell me, how does it feel?" "Empty," came the answer. Empty. That was how it felt. Salander had hardly slept for a week, and she had probably also had too little to drink and eat, and now her head ached, and her eyes were bloodshot, and her hands shook, and what she wanted above all was to sweep all of her equipment to the floor. In one sense she was content, though hardly for the reason Plague or anyone else in Hacker Republic would have guessed. She was content because she had been able to get some new information on the criminal group she was mapping out. She had found evidence of a connection which she had previously only suspected. But she kept that to herself. And she was surprised that the others could have imagined that she would have hacked the system for the hell of it. She was no hormone-fueled teenager, no idiot show-off looking for a kick. She would only embark on such a bold venture because she was after something very specific. Although it was true that once upon a time, hacking had been more than just a tool for her. During the worst moments of her childhood, it had been her way of escaping, a way to make life feel a little less boxed in. With the help of computers, she could break through barriers which had been put in her way and experience periods of freedom. There was probably an element of that in the current situation, too. First and foremost, she was on the hunt, and had been ever since she woke up in the early light of dawn with her dream of that fist beating rhythmically, relentlessly on a mattress on Lundegaten. Her enemies were hiding behind smoke screens, and this could be the reason why Salander had been unusually difficult and awkward of late. It was as if a new darkness emanated from her. Apart from a large, loud-mouthed boxing coach called Obinze and two or three lovers of both sexes, she saw hardly anyone. More than ever, she looked like trouble. Her hair was straggly, her eyes threatening, and even though she sometimes made an effort, she had not become more fluent at small talk. She spoke the truth or said nothing at all. As for her apartment here on Fiskargarten, that was a story in itself. It was big enough for a family with 7 children, although in the years since she had acquired the place, nothing had been done to decorate it or make it homey. There were only a few pieces of IKEA furniture, placed seemingly at random, and she did not even have a stereo system, perhaps because she did not understand music. She saw more melody in a differential equation than in a piece by Beethoven. Yet she was as rich as Croesus. The money she had stolen from that crook, Hans Erik Wennerström, had grown to a little more than 5 billion kronor, so she could afford whatever she wanted. But in some way, which was typical of her, her fortune had not made any mark on her personality, unless perhaps it had made her yet more fearless. She had certainly done some increasingly drastic things of late. She may have crossed the line by wandering into the NSA's intranet, but she had judged it necessary, and for several days and nights she'd been totally absorbed. Now that it was over, she peered out of tired, squinting eyes at her two work desks.